Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name.
Doubt can have so many causes. Granted that it's a fallen world, some doubt is almost a rite of passage, like my own at university, trying to find out just how much was merely inherited and how much I really truly did believe to be truth. Sometimes doubt is generated by mere ignorance. That is, we may be very skeptical just because we don't know too much about something. I recall when I was serving a church in Vancouver quite a number of years ago, we had about 120 college-age students in the church, and one of them was a young woman by the name of Peggy. She was one of those energetic bundles of life who, if she was placed at one end of a room with 50 people at the other end of the room, attracted about 90% of the energy to her end of the room. She could not think linearly. She would have made a horrible engineer, but fortunately she wasn't studying engineering. But she had these marvelous leaps of thought. She thought tangentially and adjacently and was really a very keen Christian. She came up to me one day and said, there's a chap at the university called Fred who plays football. This is American football now. And he's begun to ask me questions about my Christian faith, and he wants to take me out and talk about it. And I said, fine. I said, just be careful. It's very easy to become a little snookered yourself. Well, why don't you bring him along? Oh, okay. She said, I will. And so the next Saturday night, when I was studying, there was a knock on my door, and in came Peggy with Fred. They had been to see a movie, and now she said, hi, this is Fred. He wants to see you. I didn't believe it. He looked as if he wanted to be almost anywhere else. But I was the sort of route to Peggy. And so we went out to IHOP, that's an international house of pancakes, at 10:30 at night, and I tried to get to know Fred. The next Saturday night, duck, 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 out we went again, only this time he had a list of questions. And we talked till 2 in the morning through his questions. I gave him some things to read, and he replied with straight answers. He was as dour and as linear as she was effervescent and tangential. And the next Saturday night, duck, 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 another list of questions. He had read everything I had given him to read during the week. Another list of questions. This went on for 13 weeks. What it did to my Sunday morning sermons, I have no idea. But I got to know Fred, and at the end of the 13 weeks, he said very straightforwardly, all right, I'll become a Christian. And he genuinely did. And yes, he married Peggy. And yes, they've now brought their children up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And he's a deacon in a church and so forth. A lovely fellow. Now, all of his initial skepticism was grounded, at least in part, in sheer ignorance. He just didn't know anything. Sometimes doubt, instead, is grounded in systematic moral choice. Here's Aldous Huxley writing in his book Ends and Means in 1937. More recently, I found a very similar passage in Michel Foucault, one of the recently deceased fathers of postmodern thought, but this one is perhaps a little more accessible. He writes, "For myself, the philosophy of meaninglessness was essentially an instrument of liberation. The liberation we desired was simultaneously liberation from a certain political and economic system and liberation from a certain system of morality. We objected to the morality because it interfered with our sexual freedom. We objected to the political and economic system because it was unjust. The supporters of these systems claimed that in some way they embodied the meaning, the Christian meaning, they insisted, of the world. there was an admirably simple method of confronting these people and at the same time justifying ourselves in our political and erotic revolt. We would deny that the world had any meaning whatsoever. Well, at least the man is honest. Sometimes doubt is fostered not so much by deliberate philosophical or systematic choice as by unthought through atomistic choices, thousands of them. You may be reared in a Christian home, for instance, and then you go off and make your fortune, and somewhere along the line, you're now 35 years of age and you're married and with two children. Somewhere along the line, you're just too busy to read your Bible. You're too busy to pray. And you never talk to anybody about your faith. Superficially, everything is fine. But underneath, it's becoming at very least less important. And then somewhere along the line, doubts begin to emerge. You haven't read anything to sort of grow up intellectually. You've grown up intellectually in the political sphere and in the sphere of your own business or your own research or whatever. But in this domain, you're still a child. You haven't thought anything through. Then a few more years go by, and one morning you wake up finding yourself in bed with somebody you shouldn't be in bed with. And you say to yourself, I don't believe all that rubbish anyway. And you haven't got there because you've made some deeply principled, thought-through, philosophical judgment. You've got there by 10,000 tiny choices, atomistic choices, none necessarily integrally related with the rest. And it becomes an after-the-fact kind of rationalization. Doubt can be caused by sleep deprivation. You become a little more cynical, a little harder, a little more skeptical. The world seems a little darker because of it. I recall speaking at a youth convention in Australia about 15 years ago. There were about 7,000 young people there. And the leader called in all of the sub-leaders. There were about 380 of them responsible for their various church groups who all formed this large assembly. And the first thing he said to them was this: your most immediate responsibility this week is to make sure that the young people in your charge get enough sleep. He said, let me explain. He said, I've been to a lot of youth meetings where everybody has a wonderful amount of fun all through the week. And by the end of the week, they're so exhausted that they can be manipulated into anything. Genuine conversion, he says, does not need exhausted people. All that does is guarantee a whole lot of spurious conversions. And similarly, if people are sufficiently worn out and frazzled, they can become skeptical about the same material. Sometimes the most godly thing you can do in the entire universe is go to bed. Not pray all night, sleep. Because in fact, we're whole beings, aren't we? And how we look at things and our emotional outlook and our spiritual outlook and our take on life, all of these things are tied together, aren't they? Now, I could mention several more. Why have I taken the time to list these? The reason, of course, is because doubt has many causes, and therefore the answers to doubt are equally multifaceted. I could show you all of the ones that I've described and several more pictured somewhere or other in the Bible. But before we come to grips with what Thomas's doubt consists of here in John 20, it is important to recognize that as the passage addresses his doubt, it does not necessarily address all kinds of doubt. One needs to have a good grasp of what his doubt consists in before we see how this text addresses his particular form of doubt. Now, in fact, in Thomas's case, several forms of doubt intertwine. But let me set the stage for you. Jesus has been crucified. Quite frankly, his own disciples had not expected this to happen. They expected that he would be the reigning messianic king. He would bring in social justice. He would restore Israel to supremacy in the Near East. That they expected God's kingdom to be introduced with mighty power. And instead, he had died the death of a damned criminal. quite literally, a condemned, cursed, damned criminal on a cross in shame. And when he died, they did not say to themselves, "Yes, I can hardly wait till Sunday." Because they had no belief that he was going to rise from the dead, despite the fact that Jesus had spoken along these lines. From their point of view, it was all another part of his enigmatic utterances, very deep, but they didn't really understand. So they had sunk into a fair bit of gloom. And then the first reports on that Sunday came in. Some women at the tomb. A claim by Peter that he had seen the risen Lord. The race to the tomb described earlier in this chapter. John and Peter finding that the tomb was empty. The appearance to the two walking out to Emmaus, a little town nearby. And eventually, then, an appearance to 10 of the initial 12 apostles. And Thomas wasn't with them. So we come to our text. First, the cry of a disappointed skeptic. 24 and 25. Now Thomas, called Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe it." What kind of doubt is this? This is not the skepticism of a philosophical materialist. That is, the kind of person who believes that all that is matter, energy, time, and space. Nothing more. After all, he was a devout first century Jew. He believed his Bible, what we call the Old Testament. He believed that God had done wonderful things in the past. That God could intervene in space and time and history. He believed in a difference between right and wrong, between good and evil. He thought that there was sin that needed to be confronted and God had to forgive, or you could not be reconciled to this God. All of these things were givens for him. What kind of doubt was it? In some ways, this was the doubt of someone who did not wish to confuse faith and gullibility. He felt he had been snookered by his previous 2 or 3 years. He had expected so much from Jesus. And then Jesus died in ignominy and shame. And he wondered if the 10 who had seen or claimed to see the resurrected Jesus were talking themselves into something. And he didn't want that kind of faith. That's not faith at all, he thought. That's gullibility. There are some people, you know, who confuse faith and gullibility all the time. They think that if something sounds spiritual and talks about God and morality and miracles and healing, and if you really have faith, then it's terrific. It's all yours, isn't it? But Thomas had got burned. He didn't want to believe something that wasn't true. From his point of view, that was a dividing line between faith and gullibility. You may not have been afflicted by the account of a certain faith healer in California 15 years or so ago by the name of Popoff. Popoff had a peculiar form of ministry. He had thousands coming to his large assembly hall. And in the middle of the meeting, he would suddenly say, the Lord is telling me there is a woman, row J, seat 46. She has severe back pain. Come forward and be healed. Well, the press landed on this, of course, because it just sounded too good to be true, since there always was a woman in J46 or wherever who always had the particular malady that he ascribes to her. So they wondered about collusion. They wondered about manipulation. The press quietly interviewed all kinds of people who had been called forth by Popoff. And they could never find anyone who would admit to any sort of collusion whatsoever. They noted, however, that he wore a hearing aid. Now, what a faith healer is doing with a hearing aid is another question that I won't go into. But they had their suspicions, their dark suspicions. So they went in with a tiny, tiny camera and a device that sweeps across the electromagnetic field and locks on the strongest radio signal, a radio scanner. Because what they found out was that as people came into this vast hall, there were various attendants who gave out prayer cards to people coming in, and they were invited to put down their most acute concerns on these cards. And if then someone wrote down melanoma, 6 weeks to live, then Mrs. Popoff, who was one of the attendants, would put that kind of card in the bin. But if someone put down anything that had any decent chance of being psychosomatic, she noted where they sat and put down J46 on the card. And in the middle of the meeting, she had a little radio, which was picked up by what was, in fact, a receiver in his ear, not a hearing aid at all. And she would say, "Dear, we've got one, row J46, a woman about 45 years of age, severe back pain." So on national TV then, ABC, American Broadcasting Corporation, showed what this service looked like just to the camera, and then played it again with Mrs. Popoff's voice dubbed in. "Yeah, we've got one, dear, J46. The Lord is telling me," and so on. I have to tell you that his ministry popped off. People have such short memories. About 4 or 5 years ago, I was in California and flipped on the television in the hotel room, and dear old Popoff was back at it again. Now, I'm not denying for a moment that God can heal people spectacularly, miraculously, if he wants to. I am saying that an awful lot of the people who attended his meetings were ordinary Christians who were duped. Confusing faith and gullibility, snookered, wanting to believe stuff way outside the biblical range of things. And they thought that they were very spiritual, I have no doubt, for being there and listening to all of this. And saw it as a mark of their faith that they believed it when some of their friends didn't. Thomas would never be caught in their number. He did not want to be snookered by believing something that wasn't true. So what he demanded, therefore, was the most concrete physical manifestations that this ostensible post-resurrection apparition had genuine physical connection with the pre-death Jesus. In those days, when you were crucified, you were either tied or nailed to the cross member. And the cross member was hoisted up on the upright, and your feet were fastened in place. And you hung there, pulling on your arms and pushing with your legs to open up your chest cavity so you could breathe. And then the muscle spasms would start, and you'd collapse. Then you couldn't breathe. So you'd pull on your arms and push with your legs, and you'd breathe, and the muscle spasms would return, and you'd collapse. And this cycle could go on for hours, even for days. That was the physical part of crucifixion. And that meant that if, for some reason, the soldiers wanted you to die sooner, they'd come along and smash your shins. Then you'd sag, and you'd suffocate in a few minutes because you could no longer push to keep your chest cavity open. But when they got to Jesus, they found that he was already dead. So instead of breaking his legs, one of the soldiers took the short javelin that some Roman foot soldiers carried and shoved it up under his rib cage, pierced his heart. So that in addition to the peculiar wounds of a crucified human being, he had a very distinctive wound. The spear thrust under his rib cage. Thomas says, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe it." Here's the cry, then, of a disappointed skeptic. Then second, the adoration of an astonished skeptic. Verse 26. A week later, the next Sunday, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, this had happened the previous time as well, Jesus came and stood among them. Now, he had never done that in his pre-death experiences, but he had done it the week before. He sort of materialized, what can I say? And he did it again. Strange thing, this resurrection body. But he appears in a locked room and says what he said the last time, peace be with you. Shalom, modern Arabic salam. But it's more than just hello. It means well-being to you. Except that it's freighted now with an overtone. Because now what he wants them to think about is how they have well-being with God and with others because of Christ's death and resurrection. He's speaking in symbol-laden language that draws them out. And then, although apparently he hadn't been there to hear Thomas's protestation, he turns to Thomas and he says, put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe. Then Thomas said something astonishing. He said, my Lord and my God. Now we need to think about that confession very carefully. First, it's worth pondering how you should not understand it. Do you have occasional Jehovah's Witnesses on your doorstep explaining their faith to you? Jehovah's Witnesses, for all their sincerity, do not believe that Jesus really is truly God. And so, of course, they have to have some explanation for this passage. They have two, in fact. I won't go into both of them, but one of them says that what Thomas really said was, my Lord, my God. Now, I'm sure that if you saw somebody back from the dead, you would be surprised. But to think that any devout first century Jew would have responded then with what on any account is blasphemy, of a kind that no first century Jew would use, is hard to believe. And then you'd have to reconcile with yourself to the fact that Jesus then blesses him for his blasphemy in the next verse. And in any case, it's very hard, even at the outskirts of your imagination, where you're projecting that all of this is possible, it's very hard to deal with the little word and. I suppose if you're imaginative enough, you could believe somehow that Thomas said, my Lord, my God. But how could you believe that for an oath he said, my Lord and my God? It just is not very credible as a way of reading texts. Yet, in the second place, we still have to ponder why Thomas said what he said. Because on the face of it, on first reading, he seems to be saying more than is necessary from the evidence. Why doesn't he say instead, you are alive! Or, oops! Or, oh, I was wrong! Or, you're back! Or, half a dozen other things that spring to mind. Why, my Lord and my God? It seems to be outrunning the evidence that he demands. Why does he say, my Lord and my God? Well, for a start, you must remember that a week has elapsed since his initial protestation. During that week, you cannot possibly imagine that the entire discussion has slipped his attention while he has gone fishing or something. He has played this back all week. I'm sure that the others were working on him. I'm sure, too, that his mental reflections forced him to go back and think through all the things that Jesus had taught them. Just before he had died, Jesus had said such things as, do you not know that he who has seen me has seen the Father? At the time, I am sure that the disciples thought, another one of those deep enigmatic things that Jesus is always uttering, and they nodded piously. Yes, yes, yes. But they hadn't got it together. Before Abraham was, Jesus had said some months earlier, I am deep, deep. I am the way, the truth, the life. No one comes to the Father except by me. Or Jesus insisting in John 5 that the Father's firm resolve is that all should honor the Son even as they honor the Father. This in a Jewish context of monotheism? And then, of course, these texts that I've just cited all come from John's Gospel. But the Thomas, of course, who is here in John 20 is the same Thomas who appears in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. There we have other evidences of what Thomas was exposed to. Think, for example, of the strange scene reported in the list of miracles in Matthew 8 and 9. You recall that Jesus is speaking in an overcrowded house. People have rushed in. They're all standing, squashed together, and Jesus is speaking. And at this point, he is occasionally doing some really remarkable miracles. And some friends have brought along a paralytic, and they can't get through the press of people to see Jesus. Wait your turn, wait your turn. Wait till the end of the sermon, for goodness sake. You know, we got here first. So they went up on the roof, which was flat. Most roofs were at the time. They listened carefully for where Jesus was, and then they started taking off the tiles. And they lowered this poor chap down on some ropes in a mat in front of Jesus. Well, that got the crowd to go back. I mean, if a body's coming down on your head, you make room. So gradually the crowds moved aside, and this fellow came down in front of Jesus, and Jesus looked at him and he said, "My son, your sins are forgiven." Some people are consternated. What kind of arrogance is this? Who can forgive sins but God alone? They had a point. Supposing, God forbid, supposing you were gang raped and severely beaten up. Supposing you were terribly mugged. Half the bones in your body were broken. Now you're lying in hospital, convalescing, in considerable pain, casts everywhere. And I saunter into your room and I say to you, I have found your attackers and I have forgiven them. What would you say to me? Wouldn't you be outraged? What right have you to forgive my attackers? You're not the one who was gang raped. Only the person who is offended can do the forgiving. That is part of the literature of the Holocaust, of course. One of the most moving essays I have read this side of the Holocaust is an essay by Simon Wiesenthal called The Sunflower. Wiesenthal's entire family was killed during the Nazi regime. Simon survived. And at the very end of the war, emaciated, still working on a work crew, he was pulled out of the chain gang and told to go in and see a German soldier, a young lad of 19 or 20, who had been severely wounded and was bleeding to death. He was going to die within hours at the most. And this German soldier had demanded to see a Jew before he died. And because he was dying, the other soldiers acquiesced and pulled, by chance, Simon out of the line. Simon went into him. And the young German soldier begged for his forgiveness. Forgiveness for the things that he himself had done to Jews and for things that the Nazis had done. He begged for forgiveness before he died. And Simon Wiesenthal, in this essay, thinks this matter through. Most of the victims of the Nazis are already dead, he told himself. If only the victims, only those offended can pronounce forgiveness, and most of those who have been offended are dead, then there is no forgiveness for the Nazis. And without saying a single word, he turned and walked out of the room. He's almost got it right. The only person who can forgive is the one who is offended. That's correct. But there is another element. According to the Bible, in all of our offenses, the one most offended is God Himself. That's why David, after he has committed adultery and murder, actually has the cheek to say in Psalm 51, addressing God, "Against you only have I sinned and done this evil in your sight." And at one level, of course, it's just not true. He certainly sinned against Bathsheba, the woman he seduced. He sinned against the baby that she conceived. He sinned against her husband, whose murder he arranged. He sinned against the high command of the military, who were complicit in the arranged execution. He sinned against the covenant, and thus against the people. He sinned against his office. He sinned against the people he was ruling over, because judgment came down upon the nation. It's hard to think of anybody he didn't sin against. And yet he has the cheek to say, "Against you only have I sinned and done this evil in your sight." Because, looking at it another way, that is exactly the truth. In every offense we ever commit, the one most offended, the one most outraged, is God Himself. After all, His first commandment is, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength." So that every time we break any other commandment, we're breaking that one. And the second, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself," is grounded in the first one. "I am the Lord," he says, "therefore." So that in all the wretched things we do to one another, all our petty sins, our little hidden things, the little dirty bits we hide, as well as in the big ones that lead to an atrocity, at the end of the day, it is God who is most offended. This is His universe. We're His, whether we own it or not. And we will give an answer to Him, whether we like it or not. Which is why, ultimately, He is the only one who can give the final forgiveness. Now, Thomas was there for that exchange. "Who can forgive sins but God alone?" the critics of Jesus said. Just so. And then perhaps he thought of Old Testament promises, Old Testament pictures, some of which we remember at Christmas. We're coming up to that season, and some of us in our churches will recite Isaiah 9, written 700 years before the coming of Jesus, picturing a son in the line of David. "Unto us a son is born, unto us a child is given. He will sit on the throne of his father David. Of the increase of his kingdom there will be no end." But then he is also called the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. And now Thomas is putting all of this together. And he sees that if Jesus really is alive, if he's the promised Messiah, all of these things that he's claimed and demanded of himself, if they're true, if he really is alive, he is more than just one more person, one more human being, rather spectacularly revived. And he bows before him and says, "My Lord and my God." You know, there's a third element in this. If he's got that far in his thinking, he cannot help also but wondering what kind of a God it is who dies. World War I was, in some ways, proportionally more bloody than World War II, of course, as troops lined up against each other across one huge trench across Europe and used howitzers and machine guns to mow down 10 million on each side for the gain or loss of a few yards. A brutal war. And out of this, of course, came some of the great poetry of Rupert Owen and others. Rupert Brooke and Wilfred Owen and others. One of the poets was Edward Shillitoe. He writes in the wake of the trenches and of this account, these lines. If we have never sought, we seek thee now. Thine eyes burn through the dark, our only stars. We must have sight of thorn pricks on thy brow. We must have thee, O Jesus of the scars. The heavens frighten us. They are too calm. In all the universe we have no place. Our wounds are hurting us. Where is thy balm? Lord Jesus, by thy scars we claim thy grace. And then these lines reflecting the Thomas account. If when the doors are shut, thou drawest near, only reveal those hands, that side of thine. We know today what wounds are, never fear. Show us thy scars. We know the countersign. The other gods were strong, but thou wast weak. They rode, but thou didst stumble to thy throne. And to our wounds only God's wounds can speak. And not a god has wounds but thou alone. Thomas is now thinking of a god who becomes a man who dies on a cross. What kind of a god is that? One of the reasons why he couldn't put it together, of course, is because in Jewish thought, according to the Old Testament, a person who dies suspended from a tree is clearly under the curse of both human beings and of God. Damned! Cursed! And it didn't fit Jesus. All they knew of him was good. He didn't deserve that. It didn't make sense. But now he's risen from the dead. Vindicated. So maybe not under God's curse. Well, but he did die. He was under God's curse. What do you make of this? And then he could not help but think of something that John the Baptist had himself announced earlier in this book. Look, he said, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. And suddenly his death is perceived in another dimension. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. He didn't die as a damned malefactor. He died instead in our place and was vindicated by God for it. And he falls before him and cries, my Lord and my God. Note, too, that this is not merely a liturgical formulation. We recited words in liturgical form a little earlier. We have not done those things we ought to have done. We have done those things we ought not to have done. All in the first person plural. Did you notice? But this is not our Lord and our God. This is my Lord and my God. For sooner or later, genuine faith does not merely confess itself in the framework of sort of public utterance of a local body. Genuine faith comes ultimately to the personal. Maybe even where you sit this morning, you lift your heart heavenward and you cry, my Lord and my God. It begins there. Now let me come to the last point. The example of a converted skeptic. Verse 29, I fear, is often misunderstood. Because you have seen me, Jesus told him, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. Sometimes that's taken to mean, well, you know, dear old Thomas, he came to faith because he had the evidence laid out in front of him. But it's really deep faith. It's really admirable faith if you don't have any evidence. So long as you don't have any evidence and then you believe, then it's admirable. Okay, Thomas, well done. Not bad. But blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. Because, you see, that understanding of the verse fits in with the modern mood in which faith is disconnected from evidence or from truth or the like. If you asked someone on the streets of London with no strong connection to a living faith what the word faith means, he or she is likely to define it, whatever words are used, in terms of personal religious preference. You have your faith, I have my faith. We all have our faith. It's got nothing to do with evidence or proof or anything. I can't prove my faith. At the end of the day, it's just my faith. So you're helped by your Buddhism, and she's helped by her Christianity. In my case, I'm helped by the vibrations of crystals. I'm quite a spiritual person, you understand. We all have our faith. And thus faith, you see, is disconnected from any truth claim. There is no way that that's what Jesus means at all. Although the word faith is used in a variety of ways in the New Testament, it is never, ever, ever, not once used that way. Not once. Let me come at this through the side door. Suppose you met a friendly Buddhist, and somehow, I have no idea how, I don't see how it could be done, but suppose somehow you could prove that Gautama the Buddha never lived. Would it destroy the Buddhist's faith? No, of course not. Because the credibility of Buddhism turns at the end of the day on its internal coherence, on the attractiveness of its worldview and so on. It is entirely disconnected from any personal claims of Gautama the Buddha. So now go to India. Supposing, I have no idea how, but supposing you could prove that Krishna never lived. Would you destroy Hinduism? No, of course not. Hinduism turns, you see, on a vision of truth as being behind absolutely everything and manifesting itself in literally millions and millions of gods. So that if you somehow could prove that one of the gods never lived, well, go down the street to a Shiva temple instead. There are lots of other options. So your Hinduism is not challenged. So now talk to your friendly neighborhood imam. And ask this question. Sir, do you think that Allah, blessed be He, had He chosen to do so, could have given His final revelation to someone other than Muhammad? Now, initially, the mullah may misunderstand you. And may say, no, you don't understand. We believe that God spoke through His servant, the prophet Abraham, and through His servant, the prophet Moses, and through His servant, the prophet Jesus, but His last and final revelation He gave through His servant Muhammad. And you reply, well, sir, that's not my question. I'm a Christian. I don't read things quite that way, but that's not my question in any case. My question is a bit different. My question is, do you believe that Allah, had He chosen to do so, could have given His revelation to somebody other than Muhammad? And the imam will say, well, of course. Allah is sovereign. He does whatever He pleases. We believe He gave His final revelation to Muhammad, but He could have given it to somebody else. But we believe He gave it to Muhammad. So you see, the revelation thus gets disconnected from the very being of Muhammad. Because Muhammad is not the revelation. He's the conveyor of it. Now come to Christianity. Do you believe that God could have given His revelation to somebody other than Jesus? In Christian thought, you see, that just doesn't even make sense. It's not even coherent. Because Jesus is the revelation. He's the God-man. This is a revelation in space-time history. And if you could prove that Jesus never lived, you destroyed Christianity utterly. In fact, if you could prove convincingly that Jesus did not rise from the dead, you've destroyed Christianity. Risen from the dead literally, historically. Paul raises the very question himself, does he not, when he's writing to the Corinthians? He says, imagine for a moment that Jesus never rose from the dead. What must you infer from this? Well, first of all, he says, the apostles are a bunch of liars. Because they've all borne witness that they saw Him, that they touched Him, that they met with Him both in Jerusalem and in ones and twos and in Galilee in the north with a great crowd of 500 people. It turns out they're all liars. You can still go and talk to some of these 500. A lot of them, he says, are still alive, writing 25 years later. They're still there, go and talk to them. But of course, now they've got to be dismissed as liars. Then second, he says, you're still in your sins. Because Paul still believes that people are guilty before God. And what the resurrection does is show that God himself has accepted Christ's sacrifice on our behalf. And of course, if Christ is still moldering in the grave, then there's no evidence whatsoever that God has accepted Christ's sacrifice on our behalf. You're still in your trespasses and sins. And third, he says, your faith is in vain. Did you hear that? Paul's got no category for people who have this great faith in Jesus, regardless of whether or not what they believe is true. I remember hearing a bishop, who shall remain nameless, being asked by someone in the press, supposing somehow we discovered Jesus' body in a tomb outside Jerusalem, what would that do to your faith? And the bishop replied, oh well, Jesus has risen in my heart. I believe that his spirit is alive in the world today. It wouldn't change anything of my faith. That's not what Paul says. Paul says, if Jesus is still dead, then your faith is vain. You're believing something that isn't true. Because the Bible never, ever, ever encourages you to believe something that isn't true. And then he goes one stage farther and he says, the fourth inference to draw is this. You're of all people most to be pitied. That is, you've become merely religiously gullible. If Jesus is not risen from the dead, quite frankly, Paul is saying, you're an idiot. You're believing all this theological and existential and religious rubbish, and it's not true. You're to be pitied, not respected, not admired for your sincerity, pitied. What the bishop should have said was, well, if somehow, I don't believe it's possible, but if somehow the body of Jesus were found, then of course I would defrock myself and become an atheist or a Unitarian or something else. But you're not a Christian at that juncture. Because you see, the Christian claim is that God has disclosed himself in history with witnesses. And the way we have access to these things is precisely through the witnesses of history. That's the connection between verse 29 and the end. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. Do you see? This particular event, the disclosure to Thomas, the disclosure to the other apostles, to the ones and twos, the disclosure to the 500. They've all been accumulated together and written down in this book and elsewhere so that we have access to history. Now, faith is more than believing in certain facts in history, but it's never, ever less. It demands that we trust him. It demands that we abandon ourselves to him. It demands that we confess he is Lord and God. But at the end of the day, it still turns on the facticity, the truthfulness, the historical fact that Jesus rose from the dead, conquered death, that his death was offered up as a sacrifice on our behalf, that this happened, that he rose from the dead to attest that God accepted it. It happened in history. And these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. My friend, I don't know you. But I don't want you to believe something that isn't true. I don't want you to. That just makes you gullible. It just means you get religiously snookered. You can be ever so sincere and it might help you psychologically, but at the end of the day, you're to be pitied. But if Jesus did rise from the dead, unbelief is equal folly because it's not coming to terms with what is true, with what happened. And if you see that Christ did rise from the dead, and there are plenty of evidences for it, if you see that it's the case, then it is not merely enough to acknowledge it as an historical factum with high probability of occurrence. Sooner or later, it demands bowing before him and saying, my Lord and my God. And that's what I invite you to do this morning. If you're not a Christian, Now is the time in your own heart and mind to lift your own spirit heavenward and say, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. Lord, have mercy on me, a sinner. Or if this is all so strange to you, you've not come across it before, then at very least, you ought to try to find out what the truth is, which is precisely why this church runs Christianity Explored classes, so that you can at least start looking at the evidence for yourself. Let us pray.